All right. This here's my show, the Scott Horton Show. Thanks very much for tuning in. Got a good one lined up for you today. It's Armistice Day. Yeah, we don't celebrate Veterans Day here on the Scott Horton Show. It's Armistice Day, the day we celebrate the end of a war, rather than just venerating service to the state out of context. It's Armistice Day here on the Scott Horton Show. Adam Hofschild is going to be here to talk about the Battle of the Somme. He's got a great new piece up at tomdispatch.com today, and it's running at antiwar.com too. And man, is it something else. I don't even know if I'm saying that right. The Somme, that's how you say it, right? Anyway, it's got an E at the end, but it's got two M's. So that means that the O is still short, right? What am I, French? I don't know. Anyway, so he wrote this thing about how these idiot British generals, it's mostly told from the point of view of the British, how they just poured tens of thousands of men on machine gun nests that had not been destroyed like in the plan. And they just went on ahead anyway. There's that great movie, what you called, with good old what's-his-name in it, the blonde-headed guy from back in the days. He's the guy that played not the president, but the hero in 7 Days in May. You know the one I'm talking about. Boy, I should join up the chat room so I can get help with my trivia movie stuff. Is that Martin Sheen's father or something? Anyway, there's one where he plays a French captain, I guess, who's continually just told to keep pouring his men onto machine gun nests for the narrow self-interest of the individual commanding officers and how they can impress their superiors and try to live up to all the promises they had made, because the one guy's just trying to impress the girlfriend, the other general, because he's the father of his girlfriend and trying to marry her. So anyway, we'll just get 40,000 people killed today because, you know, that's what it means to be a lieutenant or whatever. Great movie. I wish I knew what the hell I was talking about. I'd tell you the name of the movie. It's got that one actor in it from back in the day, the one that everybody likes so much. You know the guy I mean. Here, wait a minute. I'm going to sign in the damn chat room and then someone's going to help me out. I think it's, Sheen's father. Is there a grandfather Sheen or something? I don't know about movies and stuff. What am I, a movie cricket? let's see if I can even get this captcha done. I'm determined now. This is bothering me. I'm going to find out the name of this actor so I can tell you right. All right, chat room guys, I'm signing in. Somebody help me out with the name of the actor and even the movie if you can swing it. Well, I wasn't planning on bringing it up. It just came to me on the top of my head. He's a French officer, and he's in World War I, and they keep sending him to the trenches for no good reason. I think he's a Sheen. I think he might be the great-granddad Sheen or something like that. It's one of them movie family guys, but kind of from back in the 60s or something would have been the movie. Anybody know what the hell I'm talking about? Chat room guys, save me, please. I need your help. All right, damn it. I'm going to the IMDb anyway. No, that's not going to work. I don't have good enough keywords. Well, let's see. I don't know. Movie, World War I, France. I guess I'll try Sheen, because I think it might be one of them Sheen family guys in it. No, that's not it. Martin Sheen filmography. I don't think that was it. World War I movies. It's got to be on that list. Chat room guys. Pass of Glory, Kirk Douglas. Thank you, Marco. I owe you a QR code to commodity disc. Paths of Glory, of course. It's like the path of neurons in my brain that can't remember the name of the damn movie. Paths of Glory with Kirk Douglas. Excellent film. If you have jingoists and warmongers in your family, or maybe young people who are susceptible to jingoists and warmongers, you might want to show them that one. That's what officers think of enlisted men. Oh, you? Yeah. Go and lay down and die. That's what they think. Kubrick directed, he says. Kirk Douglas is the actor. Is he not related to the Sheens? That's different, right? Sorry. What the hell do I know, man? Kubrick directed Paths of Glory, starring Kirk Douglas, the great World War I movie about the futility of obeying your commanding officers. What are you, stupid? You should shoot your commanding officer in the head instead of doing what he says. And then that way you can be safe. Or you might get executed, but you're going to die anyway. So, might as well not kill innocent people. Anyway, Paths of Glory, Kirk Douglas. This article reminded me of that because, the Metallica video or whatever little bit you know about World War I, that's what it was, being wet and muddy and cold and then bombed to death for millions of people, millions. Wet and cold and muddy and then bombed to death. Rats everywhere and, a typical day for government living up to its ultimate potential as protector of your rights, you know? Gotta protect your rights and everything. Well, anyway, here, Jared LaBelle's helping me out there on the Facebook too. Kirk Douglas, Paths of Glory by Stanley Kubrick. I'm going to try to remember that from now on. Maybe I'll get it off of the Pirate Bay and watch it twice and try to burn it into my brain so that next time I don't waste 10 minutes of my radio show stumbling all over myself trying to remember some movie with some sheen in it. Kirk Douglas, Paths of Glory by Stanley Kubrick. Thank you, chat room. Thank you, Facebook. Thank you, humans. Anyway, it's Armistice Day. Adam Hochschild's going to be on the show to talk about his insane new piece. In fact, you know what's really cool about it, too? Cartoons. They're at tomdispatch.com and antiwar.com. You can read it, and then you click on the cartoon, and it'll show you a larger picture of drawings. I'm not talking Disney, you know. Drawings from people trying to show you what the battle looked like, who was where, and why it was they got buried in the trenches where they died. And then Jim Powell is going to be here. You know, you hear it from me from time to time that everything wrong on the entire face of the planet Earth is Woodrow Wilson's fault. And then if I could dig him up and stab him to death for the rest of my life, I'd be happy. And if I had to go to hell, I wouldn't mind as long as I got to be the demon that gets to torture Woodrow Wilson. You know, because he's the worst person ever. I mean, you could argue that, because Stalin was the worst person ever. But yeah, no Wilson, no Stalin. And you could say, yeah, but Hitler, the final solution? I mean, come on. That's the worst person ever. Oh, yeah, no. Woodrow Wilson, no Hitler. No Woodrow Wilson, no Mao Zedong. No Woodrow Wilson, no Osama bin Laden. Or George W. Bush. Or Barack Obama. No Woodrow Wilson, no me. And in fact, I think I speak for a lot of us, right? When, the entire course of our history has been determined by these Democrats and their gigantic wars. And that's where our grandparents met, right? That's how my grandparents got together. Isn't that how your grandparents got together? One or the other of the world wars, or as at least a side effect, you know? Secondary consequence of the war happened to be in the place and time to create our lives. Can't resent them that much, right? I wouldn't even exist. I'd be some other person entirely and wouldn't even know it. I guess. Isn't that how that works? But you know what? It's not really a fair trade-off when you count up the hundreds of millions of people who were butchered to death because of Woodrow Wilson. And it's true that the 20th century would have sucked for a lot of people anyway, right? I mean, what are you going to do? World War I already sucked for a lot of people anyway before America ever even got involved. But it was American intervention that ruined everything. And you could say, yeah, but it's the American century and the USA did so well in the second half of it and all of that. But, you know, a lot of that was just at the expense of the rest of the world. They had all been burnt to the ground, and so America got to be the factory of Earth for, you know, we got a leg up on industrial competition over everybody else for a while there. But, you know, we could have had a good economy without being the factory of the world, without them having to be burnt to the ground in order to create the demand for our supply. It didn't have to be that way. And who wants to be a world empire anyway? Because isn't that what they mean by American century anyway? They don't mean more average schmucks than ever were able to live a pretty damn decent life. That's not what they mean. They mean America inherited the empires of the old colonial masters, the Europeans and the Japanese, and inherited 2/3 of the world, and then fought a decades-long Cold War to contain those who had inherited the other third. That's all. And anyway, you all know the story, right? Or do you not know the story? Jim Powell's going to be on the show, and he's going to explain how Woodrow Wilson's great blunder led to everything horrible that ever happened since. No Wilson, no Stalin, no Hitler, no Second World War, no Cold War, no Terror War. And you know, like I say, you don't know exactly, hell, 100 years worth of variables. Who knows how different history would have been, right? Maybe the English would have got the bomb first and would have already killed every brown person living on the planet with neutron bombs and taken all of their resources. Who knows? Could have been worse, maybe. But I'm just saying it's a fact that everything wrong is Woodrow Wilson's fault. And Jim Powell's going to be here on the show to explain. That way you won't have to take it from me. And then John Glazer's going to be back on the show, our friend from antiwar.com. And he's going to be on to help explain Israel's treachery and how they helped to destroy the P5 plus one deal with Iran over the weekend. Oh, man, I hate that Netanyahu. Here's who's no good. Israel. Oh, they're our number one best ally in the Middle East. Really? What have they ever done for us? Ever. Except for that time that they helped Ronald Reagan sell missiles to the Iranians, which he could have just done himself. It's not like it was very plausible deniability anyway, was it? Hey, the Ayatollah wants some missiles. We're backing Saddam against him. It's only fair we back him too. And then we'll use the money to pay people who kill little babies with machetes in El Salvador. It'll be hilarious. Get me the Israeli foreign minister on the phone. We'll get some TOW missiles into the hands of the Iranians forthwith. And then get me Saddam. We'll give him some chemical weapons to use to target the Iranians. It'll be hilarious. Anyway, okay, so I admit that during the gigantic comedy that was the Reagan administration backing both sides of the Iran-Iraq war that killed 1 million people, the Israelis helped Ronald Reagan do it. Okay? What else? I guess if you're an ecstasy dealer, then they're, you know, pretty good at helping supply your supply there. In what situation has Israel ever done anything for America ever? Ever? You know, we have to fight their wars for them, but then when we do, Our president's got to beg them to stay out. Oh, no, we can't have you in our coalition of the willing, or else it'll be too obvious that our wars are for you. And then we'll lose all our Arab allies who are helping us fight your war for you. So you just sit there, and the empire will do all the business of the satellite for it. Wow, some ally. Oh, you need a clean break? Here, let us handle that for you. A bunch of boys from the country in Mississippi, they won't mind dying for Israel under a bunch of lies, under the pretext that Saddam was about to attack their own country with nuclear bombs. Oh, they won't mind giving their life for a foreign state, just as long as nobody tells them the truth. And yeah, okay, so the Amal militia is on their way to blow up a bunch of Marines at their barracks in Beirut. We don't need to tell the Americans. They're big boys. They can take care of themselves. Says the Israeli Mossad. What? Al-Qaeda blew up your Khobar towers because you're occupying the Arabian Peninsula in order to enforce the Israeli policy of dual containment over Iraq and Iran after the Iraq War? Well, let's just blame that on Iran, and we'll pretend there's even such a thing as Saudi Hezbollah, backed by Iran. And then that way we can just use this to help prevent any rapprochement with the Iranians and avert the American people from the fact that there are some Saudis who really, 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 really don't want American combat troops stationed in their country and are willing to kill them and kill us over it. Nope, tell you what, let's just pretend that was Iran. And of course, Louis Free is willing to do whatever he's told by the leaders of a foreign country, so that's fine. They sell all our missile and our satellite, all our very latest missile and satellite technology to the Chinese if they can make 50 cents. They're the cause of the September 11th attacks. Our support for Israel and their permanent daily crimes against the people of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip and of southern Lebanon. That's why Mohammed Atta crashed that plane into that tower that day. You know that? He wasn't crazy. He was a soldier on the other side of the war. And the reason that he joined up was because America supported Israel. And the reason he crashed into an American target instead of an Israeli target was because America supports Israel. And according to his biographer, LA Times reporter Terry McDermott, author of Perfect Soldiers, all Mohammed Atta and Ramzi bin al-Shib did all afternoon long after they would go to the mosque, they would come home to their apartment and talk about how Americans must pay for what Israel did in Palestine today. Because it's all done with American money and American weapons. And they know that. And then what happens when September 11th happens? What happens? That same day, Benjamin Netanyahu is quoted laughing and smiling and saying, this will be good for Israel. Now we can conflate all of our enemies with America's and get them to fight all of our wars for us. The treacherous, traitorous Israelis. Our allies. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to talk to you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. In the book, Swanson explains what the revolution was, the rise of empire, and the permanent military economy, and all from a free market libertarian perspective. Jacob Hornberger, founder and president of the Future Freedom Foundation, says the book is absolutely awesome, and that Swanson's perspectives on the Cold War and the Cuban Missile Crisis are among the best I've read. The poll numbers say that people agree on one thing. It's that America is on the wrong track. In The War State, Swanson gets to the bottom of what's ailing our society. Empire. The permanent national security bureaucracy that runs it and the mountain of debt that has enabled our descent down this dark road. The War State could well be the book that finally brings this reality to the level of mainstream consensus. America can be saved from its government and its arms dealers. First, get the facts. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. Available at your local bookseller and at Amazon.com. Or just click on the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org. Hey, Al Scott here for MyHeroesThink.com. They sell beautiful 7-inch busts of libertarian heroes, Ludwig von Mises, Murray Rothbard, Ron Paul, and Harry Brown. I've got the Harry Brown one on the bookshelf now. Makes me smile every time it catches my eye. These finely crafted statues from MyHeroesThink.com make excellent decorations for your desktop at work, bookends for your shelves, or gifts for that special individualist in your life. They're also all available in colors now, too. Of course, gold, silver, or bronze. Coming soon, Hayek, Hazlitt, Carlin. Use promo code Scott Horton and save $5 at MyHeroesThink.com. All right, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's Armistice Day 2013. And this is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I really do appreciate you guys listening. I mean that. That's nice of you. And you know, it's funny, that clip, that spot that you just heard from my spot for the Council for the National Interest. Why can't America make peace with Iran? Because that's not what Israel wants. Well, you know, actually last Friday when I heard that spot play, I thought to myself, I guess it's a good thing I spaced it out and forgot over the weekend. Saturday. I thought, man, you're going to have to redo that spot. Looks like Obama's going to stiff arm Netanyahu on this, and he's going to go ahead and make this touchdown anyway. Sorry for the football analogy. That's stupid. I like the stiff arm Netanyahu part. That's all. I just like the idea of his face getting punched. Scumbag. But anyway, I was wrong. I should have never underestimated the treachery of our number one most bestest friends in the whole world, the Israelis, our number one ally. No daylight friendship. Netanyahu is right. It is absolutely absurd. That's his word. Well, I don't know what's the Hebrew for absurd, but no one disputed the translation at the time. It is absurd that the American people support Israel at all. Much less in spite of the fact of everything that they do to screw America over. You know, that was the big sex scandal of the 1990s, was Netanyahu screwing Bill Clinton right in the face. Not Bill Clinton and his little intern. Bill Clinton, the president of the world's greatest empire ever, got took in front of everyone by the prime minister of Israel, who laughed about it and mocked him. Oh, yeah. So what I told Bill, I told him was, oh, yeah, well, we'll give up all the West Bank except Area C. And then I had my secret agent inside the American government help me completely screw over the American government and the president's intentions, and we just called the entire West Bank Area C. Oh, isn't that funny? Oh, yeah, no, we just need the security zone. Yeah, and the security zone will be defined however we feel like forever. Yep. And then there was Bill wiping sperm out of his eyes. Sorry, a little overboard there. It's absurd the degree to which the Israelis know for a fact that they can get away with murder, with bloody murder, and get away with it. No problem. In fact, let's just go ahead and assume, for the sake of argument, that all the attacks in Iran by Jandala and associated terrorists over the last month were all done by Israel, without the permission of the United States, in an attempt to screw up the domestic politics in Iran and undercut their president's attempt to make this rapprochement with America. What's America going to do about it? What's Obama going to do about it? Nothing. The American people ultimately support their Congress that supports the interests of the foreign state of Israel over their own country. It's absurd. But it's true. Brings us back to the question of why Obama even tries this stuff in the first place. Justin Romano points out in his article today at antiwar.com that we don't need the French's permission to do this. Kerry could have gone ahead and signed the deal anyway unilaterally without the French and just said, well, whatever, get on board or forget you anyway. We don't care. It's not the French that have the problem anyway. I mean, I guess it's the UN Security Council, but the UN Security Council isn't anything without the U.S. government to enforce its dictates. Doesn't even mean anything. Kerry can just as easily ignore UN Security Council resolutions and recognize their right to enrich, in spite of UN Security Council resolutions. So why does he even need the French at all? And anyway, so what happened was the Israelis called the French and said, don't do it. This is from Julian Borger at The Guardian. More immediately, Netanyahu demonstrated over the weekend that he could sway the Geneva talks from inside through his relationship with Paris. It has emerged that after a call from Barack Obama on Friday evening asking him not to oppose the planned Geneva deal, Netanyahu did the opposite. He called British Prime Minister David Cameron, Russian President Vladimir Putin, German Chancellor Angela Merkel, and French President François Hollande, asking them to block it. Hollande, whose government shared some of Israel's concerns, agreed. It was French opposition that finally sank the bid to seal a temporary nuclear accord. And on, of course, a ridiculous red herring of the Iraq facility that's not even finished yet. That's not even close to operational yet. All they needed to do was just get something signed to get moving on signing more. So it could take that one giant leap forward toward healing the Cold War between America and Iran. And it's that simple for the Israelis to simply betray the Americans. Who, you know, the Americans have their own problems with the Iranians, but it's not a fake nuclear weapons program that never existed. That's Israel's problem. You know, probably even Dick Cheney would have gone ahead and just made a deal with the Iranians years ago if it wasn't for the Israelis and their bogus fake concerns over Iran's civilian electricity program here. Dick Cheney, you know, in 98 said, come on, lift the sanctions and let's do business. The Iranians are no threat. All this is for Israel in the first place. The President of the United States calls the Prime Minister of Israel on Friday and says, please don't screw this up, okay? I promise. I'll bomb them with H-bombs before I let them get anywhere near a single A-bomb. I swear, the President sobbed. And then Netanyahu went and screwed him right in the face, just like Bill Clinton. Barack Obama, president of the world's greatest empire, tiny little bitch of the prime minister of Israel, the treacherous, traitorous scum of the earth. Amazing, isn't it? Hey everybody, Scott Horton here. Ever think maybe your group should hire me to give a speech? Well, maybe you should. I've got a few good ones to choose from, including how to end the war on terror, the case against war with Iran, central banking in war, Uncle Sam and the Arab Spring, the ongoing war on civil liberties, and of course, why everything in the world is Woodrow Wilson's fault. But I'm happy to talk about just about anything else you've ever heard me cover on the show as well. So check out youtube.com/ScottHortonShow for some examples, and email scott@scotthorton.org for more details. See you there.
Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager whose site is unique on the web. Subscribers are allowed a window into Mike's very real main account and receive announcements and explanations for all his market moves. The Federal Reserve has been inflating the money supply to finance the bank bailouts and terror war overseas. So Mike's betting on commodities, mining stocks, European markets, and other hedges against our depreciating dollar. Play along on paper or with real money, and then be your own judge of Mike's investment strategies. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. It's Armistice Day, 2013, the day we celebrate the end of the First World War. Veterans Day, 95 years on, is the title at TomDispatch.com. The war to begin all wars. And It's the spotlight article today on antiwar.com as well. And you know how they do it with Tom Dispatch articles. He always has kind of a mini introductory essay, and then the other essay follows below with its own title. In this case, it's The Enduring Folly of the Battle of the Somme by Adam Hochschild, and with illustrations by Joe Sacco. Welcome to the show, Adam. How are you doing?
Good to be with you, Scott.
I'm very happy to have you on the show here. And there's birds outside. I'm going to have to go close the window in a second. But I guess let me ask you, first of all, to tell us about the illustrations by Joe Sacco before we get into the story of the Battle of the Somme here.
Yeah, well, it was an honor for me to be asked to collaborate on this project with Joe Sacco. Joe Sacco, as I'm sure some of your listeners know, is really one of America's great political cartoonists. You're perhaps familiar with the books he's done on the war in the Balkans, on Palestine, on American inner cities. A great, great political cartoonist. And he, like me and many other people, has been long fascinated with the Battle of the Somme, which was one of the pivotal battles of World War I, and in many ways sort of epitomizes the folly of that entire war. And in this new book that he's done, the artwork that he's done is a 24-foot long accordion-style fold-out where he tells, without words, in pictures, the story of that extraordinary battle. One panel just easing into another with beautiful transitions, and you see it. You see the whole thing: the hopes, the build-up, the immense destructiveness. And then to go with it, they took several thousand words of text that I wrote for a book of mine about the First World War, To End All Wars, which came out about 2 years ago, and that's accompanying Joe's remarkable illustrations.
Great. All right, so, well, you know, World War I, that's the one nobody knows anything about except that it caused World War II, even if they don't know how it caused World War II. It's kind of widely regarded as Chapter 1. So, you know, I don't know how far you want to get into all of that, but it seems like it probably makes sense to try to set up the alliance system a little bit here and then take us, so we can understand what were the Brits doing in the first place, massing this gigantic army to attempt. What were they trying to do here? What was the big deal? Why were they at war with the Germans in the first place, kind of thing?
Well, you know, the strange and fascinating thing about World War I is that it doesn't have the same kind of direct and obvious causes that so many other wars do. There was some tension among the major powers of Europe. There was a military alliance between France, Britain, and Tsarist Russia. On one side, there was a military alliance whose principal members were Germany and the Austro-Hungarian Empire on the other side. But neither side was claiming overtly any piece of the other's territory. They were all getting along rather well. The members of the royal families of these countries were all cousins and used to go on holidays together. Britain and Germany were each other's largest trading partners, so that a lot of the usual causes for war were absent. But there were a couple of things that made Europe a dangerous tinderbox. One was that there was this alliance system, as I said, the principals being Germany and Austria-Hungary on one side and Britain, France, and Russia on the other, which guaranteed that if one country got sucked into a war, the others in its alliance would also follow. That was one dangerous thing. The other thing had to do with the nature of war at that time, which is that these countries did not have huge standing armies. They had a relatively small standing army and then a large number of reserves. You know, men who had had military training, been in the army for 2 or 3 years, had to be mobilized and called up from their civilian occupations before you could really begin a war. Now, in that kind of situation, where it takes several weeks to fully mobilize an army, and especially in a huge and creaky old empire like Russia, where it took really 5 or 6 weeks to do it, if you could start mobilizing before the other guy did, it gave you an enormous advantage. So that was also something that accelerated the movement to war. And finally, the nature of warfare was such that in those days that if you could attack first, you had an advantage because it meant that the fighting would take place on the other country's soil and not your own. So these were all factors that accelerated the rush to war after the precipitating incident, the famous assassination of the Archduke at Sarajevo.
Well, and then there's the great railway to Germany here. I forgot if it was you or Tom that mentioned it in the essay, the Berlin-Baghdad railway that was going to, I forget if it was supposed to go all the way to Basra, but I remember learning somewhere that the Battle of Basra was really the first battle of the First World War. Is that right?
I'm not sure you could call it that, but it certainly is true that projects like the Berlin to Baghdad railroad really upset the British, who felt they were the ones who should own and control the Middle East. And they didn't want the Turks and the Germans muscling their way in there. Because all of these countries were, you know, jealous of each other's colonial possessions. And in fact, as soon as the war began, they began planning which of the other side's colonies they would seize if they were victorious. The Germans, who had colonies scattered around Africa, but they were not contiguous with each other, wanted to create what they called Mittelafrika, which would be a band of German-owned territory that would stretch from the east to the west coast. The British had their eyes on German colonies in Africa and actually set up a cabinet-level committee during the war called the Territorial Desiderata Committee. You know, mapping out just which territories they would seize at the end and from whom. And, you know, this is what happened when the war was over. You know, the victors, who were mainly Britain and France, seized Germany's colonies. And, you know, ostensibly they were being administered under a mandate from the League of Nations. But in fact, they were, for all intents and purposes, becoming British and French territory.
Mm-hmm. All right. And now, so part of this, I guess, about the battles in Europe, especially between the British and French versus the Germans on the Western Front, or I guess the Eastern Front, too, I don't know, but would be the false confidence that all these different, I guess you could call them, First World armies had, since they'd been fighting all natives with sticks in Africa and in Asia and things like that lately. They hadn't really ever had to deal with mechanized armies like their own, which I guess it was just at the dawn of mechanization like that anyway, but so they're trying to, you know, fight the last war with horses against modern machine guns and that kind of deal, and so it was just a slaughter all the way around.
That's true. I mean, they always say generals fight the last war, and to an amazing extent, that is true. In this case, when you look at Europe in 1914, the last war for England, France, and Germany was a series of small colonial wars in Africa and in Asia. And in these various colonial wars, you know, long since forgotten now, British and French and German troops were victorious with very little trouble on their part because they had repeating rifles, machine guns, mobile artillery, important pieces of technology of transportation like the steamboat. And, you know, the Africans and Indians and Asians whom they were fighting had almost none of these things. So, you know, the machine gun, for example, had been around for decades, but the Brits and the French and the Germans all thought of it as a weapon, you know, to be used against Africans or rebellious tribesmen on the Indian frontier or whatever. And none of their planning really took into account the fact that if a war began in Europe, it would not be just you, but also the other side that would have machine guns. And, you know, in the opening battles especially, they fought them as if the other side didn't have machine guns. And, of course, this was an enormously destructive weapon where, you know, firing 500 bullets a minute can kill a lot of people.
Yeah, well, and it's amazing, too, and I guess it's sort of, you could get all into public choice economics or whatever about the decisions that the officers make to continue on what they can tell at their very first try is a bad policy. Like, geez, you would think that any person, I guess, all things being equal, without higher commanding officers and the things that they're insisting on, would say, well, geez, I just tried to dump 10,000 men on a machine gun, on a series of machine gun nests, and it didn't work. I should try something else. Maybe go back to artillery for a little while, see if I can take the nest out, and then try again. But no, we'll just keep dumping them by the tens of thousands on the same machine gun nest that they cannot get to and cannot defeat. It's incredible.
It is incredible, and for much of the war, that's what happened. You know, the standard method of attack, and this was used by the British and the French, and we're talking the first 3 years of the war here, the first 3.5 years of the war, used by the British and French, and on a smaller scale by the Germans, usually in counterattacks, was, you know, you pounded away at the other side with artillery for several days, or maybe even a week, or maybe 2 weeks, dropping hundreds of thousands of artillery shells, and then men went over the top, as they said, climbed out of the trenches, and marched forward across no man's land under orders not to crawl, not to kneel, but to stand up, almost as if to make it easier for the enemy machine gunners to hit them, because the machine gun nests on the other side had usually not been knocked out. These were very tough emplacements built out of concrete and stone and steel, and unless there was a direct hit by an artillery shell, which was extremely rare when they were shooting these shells from, you know, 3, 4, 5 miles away, the machine gun nest was still there. So, you know, month after month, year after year, the soldiers marched into this murderous fire. The only change of tactics came in the very last year of the war, when the Germans developed a stormtrooper method of attack. So instead of doing this human waves, they infiltrated small groups of soldiers, you know, in places where they weren't expected, and it helped enable them to make a big breakthrough. But by that point, the German army was virtually exhausted. Hello?
Oh,
are you there?
I'm sorry. I'm sitting here asking you a good question with my mic off. How many people died in this thing?
Okay, in World War One, the best estimate is that the number of military deaths, soldiers killed in battle or dying of wounds, was a little over 9 million. Civilian casualties, somewhat larger than that, perhaps 10 to 12 million. Nobody has very precise figures on that because some of the countries doing the tabulating, you know, Russia, for example, or Austria-Hungary, had dissolved in complete chaos by the war's end. Mm-hmm. But we forget that this was also the first war in Europe that where the targets were civilian as well as military. German submarines were trying to sink ships carrying food to Britain and France and Italy. The British Navy was blockading Germany, trying to prevent any food from reaching Germany, and were quite effective in doing so. The average German civilian lost 20% of his or her body weight during the war.
Mm. Yeah, actually, we just, in context of Iran, but we talked with Andrew Coburn on the show a little while ago about that, and that's where his story starts, is the blockade of Germany, and how, from the interests of the men who were in charge of implementing the blockade, they had just gotten the entire system perfected right at the end of the war, and that's what they call the perfect instrument, and so they didn't want to give up their perfect little blockade bureaucracy that they had created, and so they just kept it for another few years.
They kept it going for another 6 or 7 months until the Germans signed the Treaty of Versailles. So in a sense, the war continued to be waged against German and Austro-Hungarian civilians even after the armistice brought the actual military fighting to an end.
Yeah. Oh, I thought they had kept it even longer than that.
No, I don't think so. I think they lifted the blockade when the Germans signed the Treaty of Versailles.
Well, anyway, so the thing about the civilian dead and the refusal of the officers to change the strategy, even, I guess you say the French and the British never did change their strategy at all, only the Germans did.
Not really. The Germans finally did after nearly 4 years of fighting. But as I say, the German army had been so worn down at that point. Soldiers were, you know, their principal diet was horse meat and nettles. And when the change of German strategy enabled the German army to advance quite far into France in early 1918, one of the things that slowed down the advance was that the German soldiers came across Allied supply depots filled with, you know, canned food and meat and all kinds of things that they hadn't seen for months or years. And they, you know, stopped advancing and gorged themselves on this stuff. But the British and French never really changed their tactics in a big way.
Yeah, it's interesting what a human life is worth to an officer in circumstance like that. It's Colonel Cathcart in Catch-22, right? It's been many years since I've read it, but the whole thing where, yes, sir, can do, says the lieutenant to his commanding officer, but can do means his men are happy to volunteer to raise their number of missions by another 10 or whatever it is. You know, I'm perfectly happy to volunteer other people to go and die, risk themselves anyway.
That's true, although one of the things that endlessly fascinates me about the First World War, and that I spent quite a lot of time talking about in my book, To End All Wars, is that unlike most wars, where it's the poor who do the dying, the officer class and the aristocracy in this war, because being an officer in the armies of Europe at that time was something for aristocrats and upper class people, they suffered disproportionately. You know, of the British soldiers who fought in the First World War, if I'm remembering the statistics correctly, something like 11% were killed. Of officers, it was 19%. Of men who graduated from Oxford in 1914, it was almost 30%. You know, for peers and sons of peers, it was again above average, because it was these officers, young captains and lieutenants, who led their men out of the trenches and into this, you know, hail of machine gun fire. And just to make things a little easier for the German soldiers, officers wore special uniforms where they were distinguished by the fact that they carried a sidearm instead of a rifle and had a different kind of belt and so forth. So there was a kind of a self-destructiveness by this officer class, as well as, you know, as well as destroying the lives of their men. Mm-hmm. And an extraordinary number of sons of the top generals and politicians of the war, you know, were killed in the war. Prime Minister Asquith of Britain lost a son in the war. So did the Chancellor of Germany. Chief General on the Western Front for Germany, General Ludendorff, lost two stepsons. The British Army Chief of Staff on the Western Front lost two sons. His French counterpart lost three sons. So these people were sending their own sons into this terrible destructiveness. That's what I think gives the war this haunting
feeling
of fascination.
I didn't know that. But I guess it goes along sort of with what you're saying, almost where there's just a denial about the way the war is being fought. Everybody is still fighting the imaginary war that they think is going to happen, all the honor and valor and horses on their hind legs and all of this kind of stuff, you know?
Yeah.
Very interesting. And then so now on the Battle of the Somme, this is in northern France, and how many actually went into battle on either side, and how many died in what time span here? Because it's just amazing when you hear the statistics here.
Let's set the scene a bit, and I think you can see why this battle has become sort of emblematic of the folly of the entire war. It began July 1st, 1916, and it came after, you know, for nearly 2 years, the armies on the Western Front, German on one side, British and French primarily on the other, had been pretty much frozen in place in this system of trenches that made a line across northern France and a little corner of Belgium. And in 1915, for example, the previous year, something like 1 million men had been killed or wounded, and the Allies had gained only 8 square miles of ground. So the armies were frozen in place, dug into these trench systems. And the British decided, okay, we're really going to have a big breakthrough. We're going to hit the Germans on this one sector of the front with the largest artillery barrage ever seen. So, you know, thousands of guns fired, more than 1 million shells over the course of a week. And then the plan was 120,000 soldiers would climb out of their trenches and charge through the German lines, which would, of course, be completely pulverized by all this artillery, charge through the lines, open a big gap. The cavalry would charge, gloriously through the gap. You can't have a war without cavalry, of course, because they'd been around for thousands of years. And this would be the big breakthrough. Well, what happened is they fired all these artillery shells, and if you've ever seen documentary movies of World War One, you've seen these spectacular geysers of earth thrown into the air when an artillery shell lands. Well, that's mostly what they do. The shells landed, they threw geysers of earth into the air, and it didn't accomplish much except that, unless the shell was lucky enough to land directly on a German machine gun nest, of which there were about 1,000 in this stretch of front, a dozen or so miles long. And that's very hard to do when the guns are firing from several miles back of the line. So very few of these 1,000 German machine gun nests, built, as I said, out of steel and concrete and stone, were hit by shells. The 120,000 British soldiers climbed out of their trenches, marched forward, and just got mowed down by the German machine guns. By the end of the day, 57,000, nearly half of those 120,000, were killed or wounded, most of them in the first hour of the battle. 21,000 either were killed on the spot or died of their wounds. The remainder were wounded, many of them really seriously. And it was just a disaster. It didn't stop the British general in charge, General Haig, from claiming that there was a big victory or from continuing the battle for another, 3 or 4 months. Finally, only the intense rain of winter brought it to a stop, and the army had gained maybe 12 miles at that point.
Mm-hmm. You're saying that the British general in charge was declaring victory and really just going on for his own sake?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things about this war is that generals on both sides always claimed victory. The following year, 1918, the Kaiser proclaimed a national holiday celebrating the victory of the German troops as they got closer to Paris, and it was only a couple months after that that they surrendered. You could claim victory because you had no idea how many people on the other side had been killed. And if British casualties were 20,000 or whatever, you could say, estimated German casualties were double that or triple that. There was no way of telling. And the generals really ran the war. The civilian politicians, both in Britain and in Germany, had very little control over them.
And I guess, you could imagine some younger general, maybe even, the right-hand man of the general, even trying or wanting to say, but hey, they do have machine guns, so maybe we could rethink this. But it's just all the personal pressure and the personal relationships among all these men in charge prevent that kind of rethinking.
It's true. And then you have to ask the question, where would the rethinking lead? If the rethinking was, hey, wait a minute, the Germans have all these machine guns pointed at us. We can't knock them out with artillery shells. Maybe the thing is not to attack after all. The next step is to say, maybe we shouldn't be fighting this war after all. Maybe we should sit down and make peace. But that was far too subversive an idea for any general to risk his neck, you know, contemplating or voicing.
Hey, how about just wire clippers for every captain? You know what I mean? They're all hung up in the razor wire.
Yeah, well, they had had wire clippers. There was no shortage of them.
Oh, that's good, at least.
The problem is, once you start questioning the tactics, it takes you very quickly to questioning, is this war winnable at all?
Right.
And no general
and the deciders themselves.
Yeah, no general dared raise that subject. Although I think one of the things that I would like us to remember when we remember the First World War is that there were a lot of people who took that position. And in my book, To End All Wars, I tried to retell the story of the war not as a battle between two sides, but as a battle between people who thought the war was a noble and necessary crusade and people who thought it was absolute madness and
not
worth the risk of all these lives. And there were such people on both sides. They were jailed for their opinions. I focused in what I wrote on those in Britain, where the anti-war movement was strongest. It wasn't enough to prevail, but 20,000 young men in Britain refused to allow themselves to be drafted, and as a matter of principle, many of them also refused the alternative service that was offered for conscientious objectors, you know, driving an ambulance or working in a war factory. And some 6,000 of them went to jail.
Well, that really is impressive. But then again, they were faced with, all the boys older than them from their same town are all dead now and never coming home. So you could see why they'd be pretty motivated to push back. I think about the history. It's before my time, but I'm much more familiar with the Americans pushing back during Vietnam. And you're talking about Vietnam-level casualties, 56,000 guys, 58,000 guys dead in a day.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
Holy. Put it in that perspective, you know? All of America's side of the casualties of Vietnam War in a day. Amazing.
Yep.
All right. Thank you very much for your time. I sure appreciate it.
Good. A pleasure being with you, Scott.
All right, everybody. That is Adam Hochschild. He's got this piece. It's the spotlight today at antiwar.com. Veterans Day, 95 years on. It's under Tom Englehart's name there. And he's the author of To End All Wars, a story of loyalty and rebellion, 1914 through 18. We'll be right back. Oh, man, I'm late. Sure hope I can make my flight.
Stand there.
Me? I am standing here.
Come here.
Okay.
Hands up, turn around.
Whoa, easy.
Into the scanner. Ooh, what's this in your pants?
Hey, slow down. It's just my...
Hold it right there. Your wallet has tripped the metal detector. What's this? The Bill of Rights?
That's right. It's just a harmless stainless steel business card-sized copy of the Bill of Rights from SecurityEdition.com. They're for exposing the TSA as a bunch of liberty-destroying goons who've never protected anyone from anything. Sir, now give me back my wallet and get out of my way. Got a plane to catch.
Have a nice day.
Play a leading role in the security theater with the Bill of Rights Security Edition from SecurityEdition.com. It's the size of a business card, so it fits right in your wallet, and it's guaranteed to trip the metal detectors wherever the police state goes. That's SecurityEdition.com. And don't forget their great Fourth Amendment socks.
Hey, guys, I got his laptop.
Hey, y'all, Scott here, hawking stickers for the back of your truck. They've got some great ones at LibertyStickers.com. Get your son killed, Jeb Bush, 2016. FDR, no longer the worst president in American history. The National Security Agency, blackmailing your congressman since 1952. And USA, sometimes we back Al-Qaeda, sometimes we don't. And there's over 1,000 other great ones on the wars, police state, elections, the Federal Reserve, and more at LibertyStickers.com. They'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at TheBumperSticker.com. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. Now, Jim Powell is the author of FDR's Folly, The Triumph of Liberty, Bully Boy, The Truth About Theodore Roosevelt's Legacy, Greatest Emancipations, How the West Abolished Slavery, and my favorite, Wilson's War, How Woodrow Wilson's Great Blunder Led to Hitler, Lenin, Stalin, and World War II. He had to leave out all of the Cold War and the Terror War for brevity's sake. Welcome back to the show, Jim. How are you doing?
Glad to be back. Thank you.
Very happy to have you here. And, well, we were just talking with Adam Hochschild about the Battle of the Somme and the horror of the war and the way that it was carried out in Europe and a bit of the background to it. But now you have a different spin here on Wilson's War, and it's such an important lesson, I think. I guess to set it up a little bit, basically, I think your thesis is that, or part, your first part of it is that by the time the Americans got involved in World War One in 1917, the thing was pretty much over. If we had stayed out, the war would have come to an end in relatively short order. Is that correct?
Well, the war had been stalemated for 3 years. You had the early confrontation in northeastern France and Belgium, and then the trenches were dug, and that's basically where the war took place for 3 years. Nobody was moving very far. They just had more soldiers run out of the trenches into machine gun fire. So they were stalemated, and the British had a very effective blockade of Germany, and the Germans were in bad shape because of the blockade. They couldn't get access to essential supplies. The Germans were outnumbered. They seemed to have somewhat less reckless generals, however. So it was a situation where neither side was able to impose its will on the other. And when the United States got in, when Wilson got the United States into the war, all of a sudden the British and the French had a decisive advantage and were able to win and dictate terms to the Germans. And first of all, the Germans had been completely delusional, like the other participants. Everybody expected World War One to be quick. Everybody expected to win it, and everybody expected to extract compensation from the losers. So the Germans were told by their leaders that they were winning. So when it became clear that, in fact, they had lost and that they had no place at a negotiating table, there wasn't any negotiating table, the French and the British simply dictated terms to the Germans. And, of course, that set up the nationalist backlash that generated a lot of political support for Hitler. That's how he began to develop his following, capitalizing on the bitterness, the disillusionment, and the rest developed from there. Hitler, of course, would have been nowhere without the ability to appeal to the disillusionment of the Germans, that they had been unjustly treated, that they were somehow or other going to repudiate the Versailles Treaty that contained all these onerous terms. The French and the British, of course, claimed that the Germans were solely responsible for the war, which, of course, is nonsense. Just about everybody who's written about the war in the last 100 years has come to that conclusion. British, for example, had a secret treaty to back up the French, to be in a lie with the French, to come into a war if the French got into the war. But it was, because it was a secret treaty, it had zero value as deterrence. It didn't deter anybody because nobody knew about it. And all the parties were culpable to one degree or another. But the main thing I've focused on, as opposed to all the other books that are coming out now for the centennial of World War One, they're all talking about, for the most part, they're all talking about how Europe stumbled into the war, how to get in the war. Nobody wanted it. Everybody thought it was quick and so on. My whole focus has been what were the consequences of the war, since none of them were anticipated. But now the other thing that, aside from the effects in Germany, the bitterness and disillusionment that gave Hitler his political start, the other thing that few people seem to have remembered is that Wilson, when he came in, suddenly had an interest in what the Russians did, because the Russians were getting beaten by the Germans, and they were negotiating a treaty that it was a very punitive treaty imposed by the Germans on Russia, a treaty of Brest-Litovsk, so that the Russians were about to drop out of the war. And the war had been terrible for Russia. They were unprepared for it when it happened. They did not have enough rail capacity, both to move a million Russian soldiers to the front and to deliver food for the people of Russia. So everything was dislocated from the very beginning. They didn't have enough guns to give all the soldiers, so they sent soldiers to the front without guns, and they said, when your buddy is shot, you get his gun. That's good. That's what you got. And of course, Russian parents were outraged that their boys were being sent off to war with no guns. So it inflamed hostility to the regime, and the dislocations just multiplied. The government was really collapsing because of the stress of the war. The best thing for Russia would have been to get out of the war. But when Wilson came in, he was utterly opposed to Russia getting out of the war, because that would have meant that the Germans would have been able to send some of the German troops on the Eastern Front to the Western Front, where the French, the British, and the Americans were lining up to attack Germany. And Wilson certainly didn't want more Germans to deal with on the Western Front. So he ended up trying to intimidate the Russian provisional government, and he ended up bribing them, sending them a good deal of money to stay in the war. And this is in 1917. And Russia did stay in the war. And by the summer of 1917, the Russian army was collapsing, because the soldiers were peasants. They had heard that free land was being given away. Peace, land, and bread was the communist slogan, and they didn't want to miss out on any of the free land. So there were desertions by the hundreds of thousands in the summer of 1917. And what's really extraordinary is that during the summer of 1917, Lenin tried to seize power three times, and he failed. The Russian army was collapsing. So many soldiers were running to try to get free land. And despite that, Lenin was unable to seize power. It wasn't until his fourth attempt in the fall of 1917, when the Russian army was it was almost completely collapsed, that the relatively few Bolsheviks were able to seize the key centers for the Russian government and the Russian economy. So out of that, because of Wilson bringing the United States into the war, we got not only the beginnings of German Nazism, we also ended up with 70 years of Soviet communism. And all of that because Wilson got us into the war that was supposed to make the world safer democracy. And today we hear endlessly about how terrible isolationism is, where Americans hesitate to get involved in the Middle East, they're isolationists. All of that, of course, reflects the situation in the 1930s where Hitler was stirring and Americans didn't want to get involved in it. A lot of Europeans didn't want to get involved in it. And but if you go back further and you ask, well, why didn't Americans want to get into another European war? Why didn't the French and the British want to stand up against Hitler and get him while he could? Well, the basic reason was that that intervention in a foreign war was discredited, because Wilson was claiming that's the way to make peace, is to get involved in somebody else's war. There was so much lying and misrepresentation about what the World War One was going to do, and all the good we could do, the peace, all that stuff is completely misrepresented. And if you misrepresent things to people, they are naturally going to be suspicious and step back. So the interventionists were responsible for that. If a nation is attacked, everybody can understand what self-defense is all about. The problem is explaining to people what are the benefits of us getting involved in somebody else's war, especially if it's a civil war. And there have been we're seeing a lot of civil wars today, failed states, chronic civil wars, and we're told we have to get in, we have to get in Syria, we have to get in these other places. And I think the more one looks at conflicts like that, the harder it is to see what benefit is going to be gained by getting involved. Nobody has a crystal ball. Nobody can predict whether the guys who are out are going to be in next year. Nobody can tell whether the people we think are good guys are really good guys, or whether there's something else. There are a lot of friends we have who become enemies. The biggest of all the catastrophes, I think, goes back to Wilson, when you figure the casualties during the First World War, the casualties during the Second War that came out of the First World War, the casualties under communism, not just in Russia, but in China, since the Chinese, Chairman Mao, had learned from the Soviet experience. So there you have it.
Yeah, well, then, of course, as a big part of the strategy for the American side of the Cold War was the support of the right-wing Muslim conservative religious alternatives to the nationalists and the socialists throughout the Arab world, and including the war against the Soviets in Afghanistan and the coup in Iran, and supporting Saddam Hussein against the blowback from that, and then the... once we had to contain Saddam, our old friend there from Saudi Arabia, that's what angered our old friends, the Mujahideen from Afghanistan. So all of this, that's what's got us into the excuse for the terror war expanded from there for the 21st century. And all of this is still the same chain of dominoes. And who knows what would have happened instead. But it's hard to imagine that it could have been worse than Nazism and communism and American empire in the last 80 years, 90 years, 100 years.
I think Iran is perhaps the clearest case of the fact that nobody has a crystal ball. As you know, the United States basically helped the Shah of Iran establish himself in power, and the government in the United States was very appreciative of him for helping to keep the Soviets out of the Middle East during the 1950s, 60s. But the Shah went on to establish an authoritarian and secular regime, which offended the mullahs in Iran. Ayatollah Khomeini became an enemy of the Shahs as early as the 1960s. And then when we had when there was the revolution in Iran in 1979, they are reacting both to the fact that we are supporting an authoritarian regime and a secular regime. And as I think you noted, we capped that off by supporting Saddam Hussein's attack on Iran. So we become, because we're the Shah's friend and the Shah made enemies, his enemies are now our enemies, and then we double down by supporting the attacks against Iran during the 1980s by Saddam Hussein. So now we're dealing with nuclear Iran, and the stakes are much higher. So again, it comes down to is nobody can predict if you're going to have an effective interventionist policy. It really supposes that you have a crystal ball.
All right, now hold it right there, Jim. I want to keep you for another segment here real quick, but we got to take this break. It's just a real short one, though. We'll be right back with Jim Powell, senior fellow at Cato and author of Wilson's War, right after this. In fact, check him out at lourockwell.com, what we can learn from Woodrow Wilson's great blunder. Great piece. Short version. Hey, y'all, Scott here. Man, I had a chance to have an essay published in the book Why Peace, edited by Mark Gutman, but I didn't understand what an opportunity it was. Boy, do I regret I didn't take it. This compendium of thoughts by the greatest anti-war writers and activists of our generation will be remembered and studied long into the future. You've got to get Why Peace. You've got to read Why Peace. It features articles by Harry Brown, Robert Naiman, Fred Bronfman, Dahlia Wasfi, Richard Cummings, Karen Katowski, Butler Schaefer, Kathy Kelly, Robert Higgs, Anthony Gregory, and so many more. Why peace? Because war is the health of everything wrong with our society. Get Why Peace. Down at the bookshop or Amazon.com. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org.
Fact. The new NSA data center in Utah requires 1.7 million gallons of water every single day to operate. Billions of Fourth Amendment violations need massive computers and the water to cool them. That water is being supplied by the state of Utah. Fact. There's absolutely nothing in the Constitution which requires your state to help the feds violate your rights. Our message to Utah? Turn it off. No water equals no NSA data center. Visit offnow.org.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. We're on No Agenda Radio, Liberty Express Radio, and my website, scotthorton.org, where you can also find all my interview archives. More than 3,000 now, going back to 2003. Sign up for the podcast and all that if you want. All right. We're talking with Jim Powell. He's a senior fellow from Cato, and he's the author of a whole bunch of great books, including two different ones about two different horrible Roosevelts, which you ought to read. And Wilson's War, he might as well have been a Roosevelt. Wilson's War, how Woodrow Wilson's great blunder led to Hitler, Lenin, Stalin, and World War II. And this is so important. That's not just that World War I led to Hitler and Stalin and World War II and all of the rest of this. It's how American intervention ended up screwing up everything that was already horrible and made it that much worse. And he just explained how Wilson had helped prolong Russian entry, participation in the war, so that even after the Tsar was gone, the communists had four tries after months and months to finally seize power in Moscow because the army was out of town, dying at the front, and sapping support for the interim Kerensky government. And then, of course, all of the talking points that the Nazis could have ever needed were handed to them by the situation as set up by Woodrow Wilson at the end of the war. And one of the things that is maybe seems like a minor footnote, but is important to me, I think, Jim, is something you point out in the book, and I think you point this out in your Lou Rockwell article as well, that Wilson insisted that he would not accept the surrender from the German militarists because they were just such dirty Huns, I guess. Like Dick Cheney, he wouldn't grace them with his wonderful democratic presence. So he would only accept surrender from the German Democrats who had actually been outside of power and had been anti-war, or as anti-war as they could be, and made them accept the surrender. So when Hitler went around denouncing the traitors of 1918 who sold us out and got us into this terrible mess, he was pointing his fingers at the kind of people who Americans, you would think, would have wanted to have leading Germany in the future.
Yeah, that's right. Again, this illustrates the crucial lack of a crystal ball. Wilson thought that he would be that he was doing something principled to agree to meet only with German civilians. It never seems to have occurred to him to wonder how were the Germans likely to view civilians who essentially validated or carried out the humiliating surrender, particularly humiliating since they had been told for 4 years that they were ahead, everything was going fine. That, I might say, is something that comes up again and again and again. Governments can tax whatever they want, they can do whatever they want. We often can't stop them, but the one thing they can't do, and they can't certainly can't predict it, is how people react to what they do. In Wilson's case, he was clueless about he was clueless about a number of things. One of them, when he decided to get us into the war, he was completely clueless about how about what motivated our allies, the British and the French. He was completely clueless. The French especially were determined to get revenge because most of the war, most of the destruction of farmland, most of the killing occurred on French soil. They were determined to avenge. Clemenceau, the prime minister of France, was especially determined to get even come what may. Whenever he had a chance, that was what he was going to do. And Wilson, when he got into the war, he really had no understanding for what his allies, the French and the British, were going to do. He just got in, and he thought there was going to be a congenial meeting of heads of state, and they were going to decide what to do. Once he basically, by getting in the war, taking the pressure off the French, especially in the British, he thought he was going to be in control. But of course, soon as our boys began landing in France, there was a big fight over where they were going to go. And all Clemenceau, the French political leader, all he wanted to do was to throw more American boys through, you know, have Americans be the ones that are thrown in the trenches in order to run into German machine gun fire. They wanted American soldiers to serve under the same idiotic French generals that had contributed so much to the slaughter. So there was a big fight back and forth. And, of course, the eventual decision was to step back a bit and have Americans fight as the expeditionary force separate from the French and English forces. But, you know, our friends were, they just wanted to throw our guys after the same strategies that had failed before. Throughout the war, the generals, especially the French and the English, didn't seem to grasp that a soldier wearing a cloth uniform was more than a little vulnerable to machine gun fire.
Yeah, that's what we were just talking about with Hochschild. Now, here's the thing, though, that I think you're missing. We're almost out of time here, but you got to address this, Jim. You know, the positive that came out of the First World War is that Woodrow Wilson got to be a player on the world stage. And isn't that what really counts at the end of the day?
Well, that's certainly, yeah, he...
To him, I mean. Isn't that what counted to him at the end of the day?
Well, he thought that he was going to be the leader, but again, he completely misunderstood what was going to happen, and they ran circles around him, and he had no idea what he was doing. He looked as bad as Obama did when Obama was going against Putin recently. So he had no idea what his... what his allies, what was motivating his allies and what they were going to do as a result of American entry in the war. And, of course, he had even less conception of what was going on in the, especially mm-hmm. in Germany, but also in the other countries. You know, after the war, the political parties in Europe, in Poland and Hungary, Germany, all those European, Central European, Eastern European countries, the political spectrum ran from socialism, communism, fascism.
Right. I'm sorry, we're all out of time, Jim. We got to go. Jim Powell, everybody. Wilson's War. Thanks very much.
You bet.
Why does the U.S. support the tortured dictatorship in Egypt? Because that's what Israel wants. Why can't America make peace with Iran? Because that's not what Israel wants. And why do we veto every attempt to shut down illegal settlements on the West Bank? Because it's what Israel wants. Seeing a pattern here? Sick of it yet? It's time to put America first. Support the Council of the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org and push back against the Israel lobby and their sock puppets in Washington, D.C. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org. Hey, all, Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation. As you may already be aware, Jacob Hornberger, Sheldon Richman, and James Bovard are awesome. They're also in every issue of The Future of Freedom, and they're joined by others of the best of the libertarian movement. People like Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Lawrence Vance, Joe Stromberg, and many more. Even me. Sign up for The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom, edited by Sheldon Richman at fff.org/subscribe. And tell you heard it here.
Seems strange that the DRI song would be the quiet one. Yeah, I'll have to turn that up. All right, hey y'all, welcome back. It's the show. I'm Scott Horton. That's also the name of my website, scotthorton.org. Also, you can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at /Scott Horton Show. If you like Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube, which I know you do. All right. You probably like antiwar.com too. I sure do. That's where John Glazer writes at antiwar.com/blog mostly, and also at news.antiwar.com. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing?
I'm pretty good. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, very happy to have you here. And he can also be fine, everybody, found, everybody, you can find him at the Washington Times and at the Huffington Post. So how do you like that for left, right, and libertarian and getting the work done there? That's good. Hey, listen, so... God dang it, I let myself get my hopes up that, I mean, who's going to stop the Empire? If the Empire wants to make a peace deal, then they're going to make a peace deal thing, and then they didn't. What in the world?
Well, I wouldn't let your optimism go completely away. I think that there's still a good chance, and I think that the people who have seemed to foiled the talks with Iran in Geneva are really still kind of in their kicking and screaming mode, as opposed to their, I don't think they've really turned the tide, because talks are supposed to, they're supposed to reengage on the 20th of November, so that's not too far away, and they're probably going to leave off right where they start off right off where they left off, which was really on the cusp of a brand new first stage deal on Iran's nuclear program.
All right, and then I'm sorry, because I'm obviously, you know, like a Star Wars movie, I'm starting in the middle of the story here. The deal is that there's a big fake controversy over Iran's civilian nuclear program, because I guess the Israelis pee in their pants anytime anybody says the word nuclear around them or some corrupt, stupid reason like that. And so the Americans have been trying to work this deal with the Iranians where they will just extra super verify the non-diversion of declared nuclear material, whereas now they're just plain old regular verifying it. Is that about the sum of the thing?
Well, yeah. You know, where we're at now is that the reformist president, Hassan Rouhani in Iran, initiated this whole diplomatic overture where he engaged the United States. The media likes to call it a charm offensive, whatever you think about that phrase. And now, because of that hard work that was done from Tehran, the P5 plus one and Iran are back at the negotiating table. For the longest time, as you well know, going back to the 80s even, you know, the U.S. and Israel have complained about an Iranian nuclear weapon that is imminent, you know, next 30 days or next year or next 5 years kind of thing. When, of course, that's anything but true. Right now, at least since 2007 and up till today, the U.S. intelligence community says that there is no active nuclear weapons program in Iran, and they have not even made the political decision to go ahead and do such a thing. What the you know, what's interesting about U.S. policy towards the Middle East is that a lot of it is sort of on behalf of people that are not even in Washington. So our policy towards Iran, for example, is colored mostly by the views of the Israelis and of the Saudis, the two closest U.S. allies in the region and the two other powerhouses other than Iran. Both of them hate the Iranians for various different reasons, some ethnic with regard and religious with regard to the Saudis, and probably more political and ideological with the Israelis. But both of them are, you know, hyperventilate at the thought that Iran can, you know, domestically produce its own nuclear program, civilian nuclear program. And so these fears are hyped and hyped and hyped, as you know. What's interesting is that the deal has almost was right there, and it ended on Saturday. These talks ended on Saturday, and the most unexpected thing happened, which is that, you know, the United States, which is typically the most hawkish of the P5 plus one, wasn't the one to foil or derail the negotiations, and it wasn't Iran. It was France. You know, the no, let's not go into Iraq, France, with the socialist president right now, Hollande, who has taken a very rightward turn in terms of his foreign policy. And, you know, what's really interesting about what we found out today is that the deal apparently fell apart because France insisted on a couple of things. One of the main ones was that during this six-month period before the final grand bargain, Iran would not agree to stopping construction on a nuclear plant, a heavy water reactor, in at Arak, A-R-A-K. What's strange is that's odd that was the thing that seemed to have foiled it. That was France's main objection, because today what we found out in the Washington Post is that today Iran signed a new accord with the IAEA, the UN's nuclear watchdog. And one of the provisions of that accord is that they open up their Arak reactor site to greater inspections. And so it's odd that the media is reporting that this, you know, this Arak reactor issue is what foiled the negotiations for France, when it seems like today Iran signed a new deal with the UN officials to have greater inspections there. So, you know, I don't think that I think the Iranians are very interested in the deal. I think that even the U.S. is very interested in the deal. It's just sort of handicapped by its supposed allies like France and Israel and Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, isn't that strange the way the French came and did that? There, I think the first Reuters report had a quote from a Western diplomat, which I took to be an American or a Brit, but more likely I thought an American, saying, man, old Fabius, the French representative, why, he just showed up at the last minute grandstanding, made it sound almost personal, like his, you know, just his politics or a deal that he made with Netanyahu himself or something. That, oh yeah, he just had to make this all about him. And so everybody's trying to, you know, everybody's reeling and trying to figure out what to do to try to hold this thing together. And it, in other words, it sounds to me, maybe I'm paraphrasing too loosely or something, it sounds to me like the American was complaining of French sabotage, that this was a red herring, even not from your my point of view, but from the American diplomat's point of view.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like.
Which would have been Kerry's underling, or I guess, you know, whoever, possibly a Brit.
Yeah, what we should remind listeners is that the negotiations are totally secret. So we only have two avenues for finding out about what happened. One is the public statements of diplomats after the fact when they explain what occurred. And the other is, you know, anonymous leaks to what we can gather are reliable journalists that are in there in Geneva and talking to people. Everything with regard to the leaks and the covert details of what went down, everything described France as the spoiler, came in at the last minute, just like you said, and sort of sabotaged the whole deal, which, by the way, the United States clearly was expecting to have been settled, because Kerry canceled his travel plans, which I think he was going to Asia, and instead went to Geneva to, bask in the sunlight being able to announce this grand historic deal. So it really was just like that. And now, you know, Kerry in the media is saying, oh, you know, it was the Iranians who actually derailed the deal. It was the Iranians who objected to a final deal. He's probably doing that to be diplomatic, but, you know, that's directly contrary to every leaked, account and narrative of what went down. So.
Right. Now, Julian Borger from The Guardian, who he's the author of a great piece from back in the Iraq War, The Spies Who Pushed for War, about the relationship, the direct relationship between the neocons in D.C. and Ariel Sharon's office in Israel. But anyway, he wrote this thing, Iran Nuclear Program Deal in Danger of Unraveling. I believe it's on antiwar.com today. And here he says that Obama called on Friday, and I think he's implying this was reported elsewhere. Obama called Netanyahu on Friday and asked him very politely, I suppose, to not oppose the Geneva deal. Netanyahu then turned around and called everybody else. Cameron, Putin, Merkel, and Hollande, I guess you pronounce it. And the French went for it.
Yeah, I don't know the details of that, but I wouldn't be surprised. What you saw, I think, back on the 8th, so that it was Friday, right? But it was very early Friday morning, right before the deal was set and right before John Kerry sort of arrived to speak to the microphones in Geneva. What you had Netanyahu making a public statement in front of a camera saying, this is a bad deal, this is horrible. He was all irate, he was, flipping out. And the deal, obviously, he didn't know the details of the deal, he didn't know what was going down, but he was flipping out, and it was mainly to, signal to the United States to say, oh, no, I'm fed up and I'm not going to cooperate with this. Much of this is, I think, Israeli objections. What should also be, I forgot to mention in my initial explanation of this, is that France might have its own, interests at stake here. I mean, I think it's pretty stupid for, like, a NATO member of the P5 plus one, and someone who's been so long obeying the dictates of United States foreign policy. It's stupid for them to do this, but it seems like they're trying to step into a vacuum and gain some leverage in the geopolitical sphere that the United States has recently lost. So, for example, the Saudis have been very upset with the United States recently for two main reasons. Number one, they're upset that the United States has not more aggressively attacked Syria. either in a bombing campaign or in some sort of a, you know, more direct support for the Sunni rebels. They've been very frustrated with that. Assad is one of their, you know, greatest regional rivals, and so they've been disappointed with U.S. policy there. They've also been disappointed with U.S. policy towards Iran. You know, we've been, Obama has been relatively welcoming of the Iranians' diplomatic overtures, and Iran is, you know, the Saudi regime's other primary regional rival. And so they're very upset that this possible détente could occur, which would, by the way, if a deal was actually set and, you know, it included all of the details that have been reported, as well as a lifting of sanctions, and as well as, you know, a statement from the international community that Iran's nuclear program is legitimate and they can produce civilian nuclear program, you know, legitimately. That would add a whole, you know, legitimacy to the Iranian program, and therefore, you know, Saudi Arabia and Israel would not have any legitimacy, or would have even less legitimacy, there wasn't any to begin with, to go ahead and bomb or try to sabotage the Iranian regime in some other way, which is they've long wanted to do. And so France has actually signed, you know, weapons deals recently with Saudi Arabia. In August, they signed a $1.3 billion defense contract with Saudi Arabia, which is, you know, a significant increase from their usual. And, you know, I think that France might be trying to capitalize on the dissatisfaction of Israel and Saudi Arabia and sort of gain a foothold in the Middle East. I think it's pretty stupid. I think it's short-sighted. But that's the only thing that I can really, that's the hard stuff of what can kind of explain France's actions here.
Well, now, what about the possibility that John Kerry is not a liar and that actually he coordinated the whole thing with the French and completely agrees with them that what they ought to do is object and be completely impossible here? I mean, the obvious interpretation is, well, he's just being very diplomatic and saying that through gritted teeth. But then again, why not? He did go to the French and say, hey, guys, hold me back and throw a wrench in here so that I can't make this deal today. Or maybe he didn't mind so much when they decided they wanted to throw a wrench that, oh, good, an opportunity to screw this up. I mean, we are talking about John Kerry, for crying out loud.
I find it highly doubtful that the United States policy would be to have someone else in the P5 plus one appear to take leadership on Iran, while they have, for the past 3 months or so, seemed to have given legitimacy to Iran's diplomatic overtures.
Right.
And I think the Obama administration has expended a certain amount of political capital with attacks from the right and even from their own, you know, fellow Democrats in Congress for welcoming, however, you know, skeptically, the Iranian overtures. And so I doubt that they would put themselves out on that limb and then, you know, covertly suggest to the French that, hey, why don't you foil this whole deal that we've rested our you know, diplomatic legitimacy on.
Yeah.
I think it takes a lot, especially for a warmongering state like the United States, to, you know, go ahead and say, okay, we're gonna pursue diplomatic negotiations with a state that we have been basically in a quiet war with for 30 years. Takes a lot for them to do that, and I don't think they would have done that. They probably, you know, if they intended to have France foil the deal at the very last second, they would have done it in a different way. They would have, you know, Obama wouldn't have called Rouhani last month, or they would have told Iran at the very beginning when Rouhani spoke at the UN, you know, no, we don't buy any of this, and you're a wolf in sheep's clothing, and all this kind of stuff. You know, they would have been hardcore and hardlining from the very beginning. So I doubt that that's really possible.
Yeah, I kind of meant to build into my question, you know, if they had reason to change their mind, if Netanyahu maybe had given them reason to have to change their mind at the last minute or something. But anyway, you're probably right. But it just goes to show, I think it's more likely, you know, that it just goes to show the typical situation that's not usually highlighted in this way, and that is that, oh, there's a big difference between American interests and Israeli ones, and how the Israelis won't hesitate 1 minute to sell America out for what they think is their separate best interests from ours. And so we ought to no longer let anybody get away with the lie that whatever is good for them is good for us, and no daylight and all of this stuff. Because here's the perfect example of...
Yeah, the Israelis use U.S. support and play America like a fiddle, you know, whenever they get the chance. I mean, the cost in terms of, like, if you just think about it in a cold, calculating, realist way, in terms of American interests, the cost to U.S. interests that are borne by the Israeli alliance are immense. And I can't really come up with a lot of benefits. With regard to Iran, what Israel is really doing, one of the main reasons that, you know, Iran is as a big bad boogeyman is so important to Israel is because it totally distracts the world from the much more pressing issue of the Palestinian issue. You know, Netanyahu gets to scream about his, you know, compromised security and poor Israel, we're surrounded by evil and so on and so forth. And so a lot of the diplomatic negotiations with the United States and with their other allies and with, you know, the European Union or all this is centered on this big bag boogeyman in Iran and this, you know, their impending nuclear capability and all this stuff, as if there's even the remotest possibility that Iran would ever use a nuclear weapon on a first strike against Israel or even attack it. I mean, they're just too weak a military power to even consider that. They'd have to be insane, which they aren't. And so, you know, this issue of Iran is blown up into a big fat balloon, and there's incredible threat inflation. Meanwhile, you know, Netanyahu gets to quietly continue to annex the West Bank and, you know, blockade and starve the Gazans. And nobody, you know, raises an eyebrow because everyone's so distracted by this terrible monster in Tehran, this fictional sort of caricature of an Iran that is, you know, committed to extremism and suicide, you know, national suicide and all of this stuff. I mean, it's all just a big scare in order for Israel to continue its plans to have only one Jewish Israeli state east of the Jordan River, or west of the Jordan River.
It's John Glazer from antiwar.com. John, tell them about the sanctions.
Well, sanctions are some of the worst in history. The most immediate corollary is, of course, Iraq. But the difference there was that Iraq suffered under harsh economic sanctions right after the first Gulf War. And so much of the infrastructure was damaged and people were already suffering and they weren't able to rebuild and all this kind of stuff. So, you know, estimates go as high as 1 million people who died as a direct result of the sanctions. Child mortality rates skyrocketed. 500,000 children under the age of 5 were killed. It was just a massive genocide of the Iraqi people during the 1990s. Now, you know, I don't see another comparison that's equal to it. Iran is suffering under incredibly harsh sanctions. The banking and oil sectors, the sanctions on those industries have crippled the economy. Unemployment is incredibly high. Inflation is incredibly high. Medicines for cancer patients and people suffering from chronic illnesses are being blocked from getting into Iran, and so they can't get their prescriptions and their medical treatment. It's literally putting tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of lives at risk. And it's all being done based on a nuclear weapons program that Iran doesn't have, according to U.S. intelligence. The consensus in the U.S. intelligence community is that Iran does not have an active nuclear weapons program, and they have not made the decision to actually pursue a nuclear weapon. And all of this suffering, all of this economic warfare, which, by the way, is an act of war, can't be conceived as anything other than that. It was an act of war when Germany did it to Britain and an act of war when, you know, we did it to the Japanese. And it's always an act of war and it always leads to war. And it's also incredibly ineffective. But, yeah, the Iranians are suffering big time under this. And that's probably one of the reasons that they've come to the negotiating table, although that doesn't speak too well. It's not like to praise the sanctions, because the Iranians also tried to come to a negotiating table back in 2001, and they did it in the 90s, and they've had all these proposals and these overtures that have failed because the United States has had the power and the capability to ignore, when a good deal is staring them right in the face. So, if these sanctions get lifted and if there's a deal that actually occurs and that adds legitimacy to Iran's peaceful nuclear program, that could be an enormous thing. I mean, that would be absolutely enormous. And for U.S. relations with Iran and U.S. policy towards the Middle East in general. But I think that the people who really want U.S. policy to stay the same and to continue to be belligerent and to continue to be the way it has been since World War II, people in Israel and people in Saudi Arabia in particular, they want to foil this deal. Yeah. It's a giant threat to them that in the same way that, the U.S.-Russian deal to have the Assad regime take his chemical weapons and destroy them, in some sense, that gave some legitimacy to the Assad regime because they have to cooperate in this elimination of the chemical weapons, right? So that gave legitimacy to them, and anything the U.S. did from that point on to try and deliberately and obviously topple the regime would have been seen as just, beyond the pale. In the same way, if Iran carries out these concessions that they're offering, and reduces their nuclear program and reduces the enrichment limits and, agrees to more inspections and all of this kind of stuff, it adds legitimacy to the Iranian regime. That is the last thing that Israel or Saudi Arabia wants, because any legitimacy given to the Iranian regime is a net loss, in their view, in terms of their political and geopolitical dominance over the region.
Right. Which just goes to show that they're not even really concerned about the nuclear program at all. What they're really concerned about is the permanence of that particular regime.
Precisely. They're worried about geopolitics. They're worried about Iran's power in the region compared to theirs. And that's about, the nuclear weapons have something to do with that. If Iran did have a nuclear weapon, the balance of power would shift greatly. But they don't. But they want to be able to maintain this balance of power, but the Israelis are the greatest military hegemon in the region, and the Saudis, have prominence thanks to a close relationship with the U.S. and the boogeymen in the Shiite regimes. And so, they want to maintain that, and they want to foil this deal. And I'm not sure whether it will be foiled or not. We'll have to see. The next negotiations come later this month, and fingers crossed that they come before the Congress gets the chance to impose additional sanctions, which, by the way, will signal to Iran that the United States isn't serious about this and they should abandon negotiations.
Well, and great, because this is the part where what we need here is some real presidential leadership that, hey, I'm determined to make a peace deal here, Congress, and I don't appreciate you holding me back, even if he's got to give a big speech or something, but is the president willing to fight for it? And for 10 whole days, I don't know, man.
Yeah, I don't have a lot of confidence in Obama. He's always done things for the sake of his own political reputation and legacy, and I think that if he's going to be seen by most of Congress, even his fellow Democrats, as an appeaser, I don't think that he's willing to take the risk. And he's not willing to take the heat from a Israeli prime minister that has a quick tongue and likes to go on out in front of the world, in front of the public, and scream about how America's throwing him under the bus. I don't have a lot of confidence that he's willing to take that sort of political damage. But we just have to hope that maybe some behind-the-scenes stuff to quiet the hardliners like McCain and Graham and Robert Menendez and all of these people in the Senate that just want to foil the deal. We have to hope that they're somehow staved off. And we'll see what happens later on in November.
All right, everybody, that's John Glazer from antiwar.com at antiwar.com/blog, mostly. Why did France torpedo the Iran negotiations? And you can also find him at the Washington Times. Thanks very much for your time, John. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
All right, y'all. Go read Jim Powell at lewrockwell.com, the short version of the book. It's what we can learn from Woodrow Wilson's great blunder and George Bush's, the Woodrow Wilson of the 21st century there. See y'all tomorrow. Thanks for listening.